dive on their 16-month-old at a university, wondering if they're going to get shot in the back.
Authorities are working to learn what led to the fatal shooting of conservative activist Charlie Kirk yesterday in Utah.
Today is Thursday, September 11th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Today, Americans mark the 24th anniversary of the September 11th attacks.
They launched an unprecedented focus on how to protect the country from terrorism.
How counterterrorism has changed since 9/11.
What a poorly named military campaign to call something the global war on terrorism, because terrorism's a tactic. It never ends.
Also, a look at Downton Abbey's grand finale.
And we meet a man keeping Latin jazz music history alive through sheet music.
I was thinking to myself, man, I think the kids would really like playing this stuff.
And what's this week's Word of the Week?
We'll find out. First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. The assassination of political activist Charlie Kirk at Utah Valley University yesterday has raised concerns about security and free speech on college campuses. NPR's Martin Costi reports.
Security experts have focused on the fact that the Charlie Kirk event was open air with no screening of spectators to get in. There's been speculation that whenever contentious ideas are involved, these open air events may no longer be feasible on college campuses. But Rodney Chapman, vice president of the International Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators, says campus police chiefs are not strangers to handling controversial visits.
I think outdoor events typically have greater risk. Does that mean that these will be impossible to have going forward? I don't think so.
But another former campus police chief tells NPR that this shooting may be, quote, a game changer when it comes to the degree of security that campuses bring to politically charged events. Martin Costi, NPR News.
Some 300 South Korean citizens are on their way back to Seoul today after being detained in Georgia last week by federal immigration authorities. As WABE's Sam Greenglass reports, the South Korean workers were helping to open a massive electric vehicle battery plant that has been championed by top Georgia Republicans.
Republicans in Georgia spent years building ties with companies in South Korea, culminating in Hyundai locating a multi-billion-dollar electric vehicle plant near Savannah. But the raid last week at the battery facility has put some Republicans like Governor Brian Kemp in a tricky position, says GOP strategist Brian Robinson.
He's got to, on the one hand, consider his politics in Georgia, but also he's got to make sure that the South Koreans feel appreciated and make sure that bridges don't get burned.
The raid is highlighting some tensions between President Trump's immigration crackdown and his push to reinvigorate American manufacturing. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Atlanta.
Inflation rose last month as consumers paid more for gasoline and groceries. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on the latest cost of living index.
Consumer prices in August were up 2.9% from a year ago. That's a sharper annual increase than the previous month. Prices rose 0.4% between July and August, fueled by rising costs for rent, groceries, and gasoline. Americans also paid more last month for clothing, airfares, and new and used cars. August was the month when President Trump imposed higher tariffs on many U.S. trading partners, which may have contributed to higher prices for imported goods like coffee. A federal appeals court has ruled most of those import taxes are illegal, but they remain in effect pending a review by the U.S. Supreme Court. The High Court said this week it would hear arguments in the tariff case in early November. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And this is NPR News. In an opinion piece in the Washington Post, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Education Secretary Linda McMahon argue against school-based mental health screenings. They write that schools need to, quote, offer natural sources of mental health well-being, close quote. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee has more.
The two secretaries argue that schools must turn to things like, quote, strong families, fitness and nutrition, and hope for the future, close quote, to help kids. They say mental health screens, diagnoses, and talk therapy create stigmas that stay with children. Psychologist Benjamin Miller chairs the advisory board for the mental health nonprofit Inseparable. He says mental health screens are like those for physical health, intended for early detection so someone at risk can get help before it develops into a health crisis.
We screen all the time in schools for things like vision and hearing. So it makes a lot of sense that we would just continue to screen for things that are equally as important, like our mental health, which is so foundational.
Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
The United Kingdom's Foreign Office has fired its ambassador to the United States, Peter Mandelson, over his alleged ties to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The British newspaper The Sun published private emails Mandelson engaged with Epstein in 2008, encouraging Epstein to continue the legal fight to stay out of prison after he was indicted by a grand jury on sex-related charges. In an interview Wednesday before he was fired, he called Epstein a charismatic liar and says he regrets he ever fell for his lies. I'm Dan Ronan, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Grand Rapids Farmers Market, open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the intersection of Golf Course Road and Pokegama Avenue, offering an EBT double match and many more programs, bringing produce to members of our community. More at grfarmersmarket.org. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The FBI is now offering a $100,000 reward for information leading to the identification and arrest of the individual or individuals responsible for the killing of Charlie Kirk. And FBI Director Kash Patel is headed to Utah, that according to a source not authorized to speak publicly. Charlie Kirk is the Trump ally and conservative activist shot and killed on the campus of Utah Valley University yesterday. NPR's Kirk Sigler joins us now from that campus in Orem, Utah. Hey, Kirk.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Would you start by bringing us up to speed with the latest in this investigation? The FBI has now released two pictures of someone they are calling a person of interest.
That's right. These images, Mary Louise, show a younger man. The FBI is describing him as someone who definitely fit in on a college campus. He does look to be a typical age of a college student. These photos are a bit grainy, but in them, the man they're calling, as you say, a person of interest, is wearing a hat, black sunglasses, black long-sleeve T-shirt with a partial view of an American flag on it. Authorities are telling us that they recovered a high-power bolt-action rifle. That's in a wooded area. Investigators found this near us here, that they say may be where the gunman left it as he fled the scene yesterday, running into a neighborhood adjacent to this sprawling campus. And now we have this manhunt going on. More than 24 hours later, he's still on the run.
Yeah, and then setting aside his whereabouts, what have you learned today about the circumstances that led up to the assassination?
Well, information has been, you know, somewhat frustratingly slow to trickle out. We were expecting another press conference this afternoon. Then authorities canceled it abruptly on short notice, saying there were just too many rapid developments, they said, in this case. So we're here waiting for more information and another announcement. Here's what we know for sure. I can tell you, Mary Louise, authorities say the suspected gunman came onto this campus about a half hour before he shot Kirk yesterday at this event that had about 3,000 attendees. They have surveillance video. They've been showing him moving through stairwells onto a roof where he fired down onto the event from. Then he flees immediately, runs through this adjacent neighborhood we've been talking about. Uh-huh. But beyond this, you know, we have few other confirmed facts. Police aren't saying whether or not they believe the gunman is still loose in this area where I am or if he's fled. They are insisting, though, calm, that this is an isolated attack and there's no threat to the broader community. But Mary Louise, like, standing here, I have to tell you, you can imagine it's pretty tense, especially with all the heated rhetoric that's been going around online.
Yeah, and just tell me more, paint a picture for me of what this campus looks like. I gather it's closed till next week.
That's right. It's a large suburban campus, more than 40,000 students. I'm just north of Provo and BYU. And, you know, looking around right now, it's pretty much deserted, apart from cops at barricades at all the entrances and us reporters and satellite trucks, TV satellite trucks. I did just see a couple flower bouquets that people have been putting down on the sidewalks in front of me. And earlier, I was at a press conference early this morning. We were in one of the buildings, and it was really an unnerving sight. You could see just student belongings, like half-eaten lunch headphones just sitting on desks abandoned when everybody ran yesterday. I met Elliot Thorne. He came to the Kirk event yesterday with his wife and 16-month-old son from a nearby city. He came back today to see if he could get their stroller and some other things that, you know, they just abandoned in the chaos, but it's now a crime scene, so he couldn't. And he talked to me for a minute, and he said, you know, he's an avid conservative, and he is just devastated.
We live in a society now where this is being normalized. You know, no father should have to dive on their 16-month-old at a university wondering if they're going to get shot in the back, saying a prayer to God, like, please hit me and not my child, like, or watching children screaming and witnessing an assassination.
Mary Louise Thorne told me, you know, he's hoping that this tragedy is what may finally cause Americans to come together and agree that the violence has to stop. But, you know, I got to say, covering the country right now like I do, being here in Utah as well, it's hard to see that that might happen anytime soon.
NPR's Kirk Sigler, I have the feeling we'll be checking in with you all evening as we await further developments. Thanks so much for your reporting.
You're welcome.
Everyone has an idea of what a robot is, but do you know where the word came from? NPR's Emma Bowman has the answer in the latest installment of our Word of the Week series.
When Melania Trump used the word just last week during a meeting with the White House Task Force on AI education, she was referring to artificial intelligence.
The robots are here. Our future is no longer science fiction.
Back in 1920, Czech writer Karel Čapek first imagined the robot in his play RUR, Rossum's Universal Robots. In the satirical melodrama, the character Harry Doman runs a factory that churns out mechanical humanoid workers made of synthetic flesh and blood.
The robots are not people. Mechanically, they are more perfect than we are. They have an enormously developed intelligence, but they have no soul.
The work is what introduced robot to the English language. A negative connotation was built into the word from the start.
Modernity is turning us all into machines. That's kind of the message.
Tobias Higbee teaches labor history at UCLA. He says Čapek's work critiqued the socio-political climate of the time. The rhetoric of the Doman character echoed that of Henry Ford, the industrialist who pioneered mass production with assembly lines. As technology advanced in auto production and elsewhere, the idea of the robot began evolving, and talk soon pivoted to
how it would hurt workers by throwing them out of their jobs and denying them their livelihood.
So robots became analogous to machines, not workers. That's how we got to Blade Runner, Terminator, and iRobot. Through it all, robot has held on to its same loose definition, says linguist Adam Alexic.
There's always this implication of it is a forced worker.
He says Čapek's Army of Roboti, which translated to robot in English, derives from the old Slavic word robota, meaning servitude or forced labor. The robot usually carries the looming threat to extinguish the human race. It all goes back to RUR.
You know, spoiler alert, at the climax of the play, the robots gain self-consciousness and slaughter all the humans.
Nowadays, robots are being marketed as our assistants, girlfriends, pals, and our equals. Interpretations of the robot that stray further than ever from the word's definition in its 100-year history. Emma Bowman, NPR News.
Ring for the butler, set a table for tea. The Crawleys are coming for the first time without Dame Maggie Smith.
If Mama were alive, what would she do?
Six TV seasons, two previous films, and now what producers are calling Downton Abbey the grand finale. Our critic Bob Mondello sounds skeptical.
Finale? Come on. I mean, it is grand, but with the first two movies having taken in nearly $300 million, it's hard to imagine this saga won't go on indefinitely. The Crawleys riding out the Blitz next time, maybe, someday having the Beatles to tea. For now, though, it's 1930, and scandal is brewing. Lady Mary, dressed in scarlet, wouldn't you know, is dancing at a stately home in London when the hostess, who's just seen a newspaper headline, pulls her and her parents aside.
Lady Mary must go now. She's divorced.
Divorced? Good heck. Wait, what?
I'm very sorry. I shouldn't have come.
This is a woman who once had a Turkish diplomat die in her bed. But Never mind, give series creator Julian Fellows his plot points. There are, as always, a lot of them, from county fairs to the races at Ascot, and one financial one, this is the Great Depression, remember, that threatens the very existence of Downton.
Welcome back, my brother.
Cora.
The news is bad, isn't it?
How could you tell?
I've known you since you were born.
Hal's made a real mess of things, hasn't he?
He has.
Don't you see what this means for Downton?
Longtime viewers will be pleased to know that pretty much everyone is back, even in a sense those who've died. And there's also a visiting celebrity, playwright and entertainer Noel Coward, who delights in being provocative and who's always on the lookout for material.
Lady Mary, come and meet Noel.
Oh, I thought it was just a few locals. It's so good of you to come all this way.
I was talking earlier to your uncle about your divorce. What happened? Don't worry, if you'd rather not say.
No, I'll say. We fought like cats. He wanted to be kingpin, but I was the heiress. And he was just the husband. He hated that.
How intriguing.
He's soon conjuring Private Lives, his most popular play, while we're checking in on the private lives of pretty much all the Downtonites. The old guard is retiring from the reluctant Earl.
It's hard to accept that it's time to go.
To Butler Carson, still worried about silver polishing, but waxing philosophical.
You look back and think about all the changes you've witnessed.
To Mrs. Patmore, who's handing the kitchen over to young Daisy.
You're the daughter I never had. I'll treasure those words.
Then there's Mary.
Families like ours must keep moving to survive.
Like sharks. The point of all this movement in narrative terms is keeping audiences engaged. After being wildly successful at that for nearly 15 years, Fellows and his crew aren't about to slacken in the stretch. They've introduced an American snake in the garden that is Downton to tempt Mary.
Surely you're entitled to have some fun.
And they've put a lot of signposts amid the beaded gowns and elegies to a bygone age.
This is Mary's time. She's in step with how to run this estate in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s.
Which is why I'm not entirely convinced by all this talk of finales. There's a youngster named George on the sidelines here. He has nary a line, but as Mary's son, he will inherit Downton at some point. If I've got the chronology right, he's about 9 in 1930, meaning he'll be 18 when Germany marches into Poland, 31 when Elizabeth assumes England's throne, 42 when the Beatles release Love Me Do, at which point Mary and Edith will be approaching the age of the Dowager Countess and her frenemy, Isabel. So I, for one, won't be surprised.
Long live Downton Abbey.
Amen to that.
If this grand finale isn't all that final. I'm Bob Mundell.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is The Setlist on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at shows Thursday through Saturday, September 11th through the 13th, in Grand Rapids, Aiken, Coleraine, and Big Fork. First up, folk singer-songwriter Rachel Kilgore is coming to the Co-House in Grand Rapids Thursday at 7:30 p.m. The Duluth singer won the 2017 Careville New Folk Contest and most recently released the album My Father Loved Me in 2023, which explored her relationship with her late father. She is a 2025 McKnight Music Fellow. It is Rachel Kilgore this Thursday at the Co-House in Grand Rapids. On Friday, Jay Bell and the Lazy Susan Band are playing The Terrace in downtown Aiken at 7 p.m. An Americana and rock and roll band that features a horn section, B3 Hammond, and twangy guitars, they've released 6 albums since forming in 2001. Jay Bell and the Lazy Susan Band in Aiken Friday night. On Saturday, the Bugle Boys are playing at Smoke on the Water in Coleraine at 6 p.m. A stripped-down duo of vocalist and guitarist Clay Fulton and the drummer from his band The Lost 40, the Bugle Boys play a stomping and rowdy brand of folk blues music. Saturday in Coleraine at Smoke on the Water. Finally, Sam Miltich and friends are playing at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork, Saturday at 7 p.m. The Militici new music from the Old Country Show will feature the jazz group's take on Balkan and other Eastern European folk music. a style Miltich explored on his 2019 album, Peasants with Torches. Sam Miltich and friends in Big Fork this Saturday. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at KAXC.org.
Comes from this station. And from Focus Features, presenting Downton Abbey, the grand finale, concluding the story of the Crawley family. This motion picture event can be experienced in theaters tomorrow. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. 24 years ago, the 9/11 attacks launched an unprecedented focus in the U.S. on terrorism and how to protect the country from it. But over the years, the threat landscape has become much more complex. And those who study counterterrorism say that the work that was underway to meet that challenge is being dismantled. NPR's domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef reports.
When the planes hit the Twin Towers, Jason Blazekas was perhaps one of a very small number of Americans who actually had some clue what might have happened.
And immediately, as somebody who's written already at that point a lot about extremism, terrorism, my mind did turn to Osama bin Laden.
That morning, Blazekas was actually on an Amtrak train from New York to D.C. He was obtaining a graduate degree in New York, intending to go into law. But that day changed everything. Blazekas resolved instead on government service. He was part of a wave of Americans whose career trajectories were fundamentally shaped by that day's events. He started in the world of intelligence.
But then the last 10 and a half years of my government service specifically was in that world of counterterrorism, where I headed up an office at the State Department that's responsible for sanctioning terrorists pursuant to U.S. law.
Across the ocean, Colin Clark was a college senior studying abroad in Ireland when the towers came down. He was researching the Good Friday Agreement, which ended the 30-year conflict known as the Troubles. But the 9/11 attacks turned his focus toward transnational terrorism.
I grew up in New York, not too far from Queens, and immediately I became obsessed with this group called Al-Qaeda, and who were they, and why did they attack the United States, and what was Salafi jihadism, and what the hell was going on in Afghanistan?
Clark went on to study and work on the topic of terrorism with think tanks. Clark says at that time, Americans' notions of what terrorism was were largely shaped by then-President George W. Bush.
We will do everything we can to achieve our objective, which is to rout out and destroy global terrorism.
But Clark says that messaging, in retrospect, was facile.
What a poorly named military campaign to call something the global war on terrorism, because terrorism's a tactic. It never ends.
Clark says this framing of the conflict led to open-ended wars in Afghanistan, then in Iraq. Also, that conception of terrorism centered on a single ideology, Salafi jihadism. And Blazekas says that led to missteps.
We all remember NYPD, for instance, using its intelligence functions in the early days in the aftermath of 9/11, trying to infiltrate mosques, right? Completely inappropriate behavior, and really doesn't speak to prevention in the sense that we think of prevention today.
The shift to prevention has been a major change in the counterterrorism field, and it was in part forced by the reality that Americans are also targeted by other Americans for ideological and political reasons.
The Tree of Life attack in Pittsburgh was very personal.
17 years after the 9/11 attacks, Colin Clark was getting his PhD at the University of Pittsburgh. Right in his neighborhood, there was a mass shooting at a Jewish synagogue.
I remember it clearly. It was my wife's first day back at work after maternity leave, so I was taking care of a 3-year-old and a 3-month-old. And as usually happens after a horrific terrorist attack, my phone started ringing off the hook with reporters and journalists and, you know, analysts wanting to know what happened.
What happened was a white nationalist had bought into an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that characterized refugees in the U.S. as invaders. He went to a synagogue and killed 11 people. And just a year earlier, white nationalists and neo-Nazis had rallied openly in Charlottesville, Virginia, killing a counter-protester.
You know, I think it led me to kind of then jump in with both feet into studying the far right and the Great Replacement Theory and neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and this very kind of broad patchwork of, you know, violent extremists.
Today, practitioners and researchers largely agree that the ideology of terrorists is less important than addressing the vulnerabilities that make some people susceptible to them. It's a view that is supported by instances where, for example, some extremists have swung from affiliation with neo-Nazi groups to militant jihadist movements. The Biden administration's groundbreaking national strategy for countering domestic terrorism was a major step in recognizing and funding prevention work. Blazekas says that work was only just getting started. But prevention was always a trickier sell than, say, arguments for increased government surveillance or law enforcement.
There was always an agreement, though, in government circles that this is a really thorny issue, one that's very difficult to measure in way of success, because how do you measure something that never happened? And that's what prevention ultimately is trying to do, is to prevent people from ever joining extremist groups and to walk away from the path of violence.
In the last 8 months, much of the prevention infrastructure of the Biden administration has been eliminated. And now the very definition of what terrorism even is becoming increasingly blurred. Trump has defended a military strike on what he has called a, quote, drug-carrying boat off the coast of Venezuela with the claim that those on the boat were terrorists. Blazekas says drug cartels are a different thing from terrorists. They are motivated by financial gain, not by political or ideological goals. The tools needed to fight these things are different.
In conflating these two things, it moves personnel away from those more traditional terrorism threats like ISIS and Al-Qaeda towards focusing on drug cartels that may not pose quite the same level of political threat to U.S. interests.
I would argue it's not well thought out and it could be a slippery slope.
Colin Clark is also concerned about this attempt to reorient national resources for counterterrorism toward other issues that haven't fallen under the ambit of national security.
And so for a lot of folks in the counterterrorism field, this is a real crossroads moment of, like, what is our strategy and where are we going?
Odette Youssef, NPR News.
School is back in session, and like any working machine, it takes a lot of hands to make things run smoothly.
It's a strange connection between us and the students.
That's Patty Moreno, and she's one of many people who keep the instruments for public school kids in Los Angeles in tune and working for free.
She and her colleagues say this service helps keep music education accessible to all students. Student Maximiliano Segura agrees.
I love music. I express myself through it, and I think it's just one of my best therapies that I could ever have. And I feel like everyone should have the opportunity to express themselves.
On tomorrow's All Things Considered, we take you to one of the last publicly funded music repair shops in the country.
Find out which music legend is chipping in to support their work. Turn on your radio, or you can ask your smart speaker to play your local station. This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Thanks to our listeners, we've raised over $162,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate or share our work. Visit KAXE.org. Now it's time for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Authorities in Carleton County are seeking public assistance in locating a missing Escoban. 25-year-old Antonio Jose Sarasua was last seen leaving his home on Monday. He drives a blue 2017 Subaru and has made past comments about living in his car and traveling to Texas, according to a news release. Sarasua is described as 5'11" with brown hair and brown eyes. His family is concerned for his well-being as they haven't heard from him since he was last seen. Anyone with information is encouraged to contact the Carleton County Sheriff's Office or dial 911. The DFL Minnesota Senate is creating a subcommittee to study the impact of the Big Beautiful Bill signed into law on July 4th. The Select Subcommittee on Federal Impacts on Minnesotans and Economic Stability will have Republican and DFL members. The Minnesota Reformer reports the group will travel around the state to hear from farmers, hospital administrators, people reliant on food or medical assistance, and others impacted by recent changes to federal law. The committee will alternate weekly meetings between St. Paul and affected communities beginning Thursday. Republican Senator Paul Utke of Park Rapids is among those named to serve. Governor Tim Walz announced the appointment of Assistant Roseau County Attorney Michael Grover as a district court judge. He will assume the bench in Roseau County upon the retirement of Judge Donna Dixon. Walz said Grover is a, quote, familiar face to both the community and the justice system, and his commitment to treatment courts and justice innovation fosters greater public trust in the justice system. Grover was one of three candidates nominated by the Commission of Judicial Selection that included Bemidji City Attorney Katie Nolting and Thief River Falls Public Defender Max Schaefer-LeCoursier. A new study from the University of Minnesota School of Public Health found that access to obstetric care across the country has declined and that those closures have hit rural communities the hardest. The Daily Yonder reports the data included the years 2018 to 2022, when national policies designed to preserve obstetrics units were already in place. The study looked at the status of obstetric services between 2010 and 2022 in nearly 5,000 short-term acute care hospitals in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Using an enhanced algorithm, the researchers determined whether hospitals stopped providing obstetric services over the 12-year period and whether those hospitals were in urban or rural areas. Seven states saw nearly a quarter of their hospitals close their obstetric units. The researchers found, by the end of 2022, two-thirds of rural hospitals in eight states were without obstetric services. Previous research found that in states that chose to expand Medicaid, there were delays in closing obstetrics units, but it did not stop the units from shutting down. A study in Obstetrics and Gynecology published this month found that residents in a maternity care desert are more likely to have a higher rate of maternal and pregnancy-related death. The study found that poor maternal health outcomes in the U.S. rose 89% since 2018 because of structural inequities in healthcare access, particularly in rural and underserved areas. A WCCO investigation found that since 2021, nearly 20 hospitals in the state have moved or closed labor and delivery services, including at Essentia Health in Fauston. The Superior National Forest plans to begin prescribed burns as early as this week. Pile burns will begin on the eastern side of the forest's Gunflint and Toft Ranger districts, pending required approvals. The western side will see prescribed burns when conditions improve. The work is likely to continue through December as weather conditions allow. Prescribed burns are used to reduce overgrown vegetation to help protect from wildfires. Weather conditions will be evaluated before burns begin, and county emergency management officials will be notified of prescribed burning activity. Broadband expansion projects underway in parts of Itasca and St. Louis counties are expected to be completed before the deep freeze. Member-owned cooperative Paul Bidding Communications reported the various projects are on track as construction season in northern Minnesota nears its end, including those in Coleraine and Bovee. The company says that once the network is operational in an area, customers who signed up will be contacted to schedule service installations, see the status of all the projects, and find out more info at KAXE.org. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 9.5 inches of ground clearance. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Before he was killed on Wednesday, Charlie Kirk was among the most influential voices in young conservatism. He played a pivotal role in President Trump's return to the White House. NPR's Shannon Bond has more on Kirk's life and legacy.
Charlie Kirk was just 18, barely old enough to vote, when he launched the campus activist group Turning Point USA. Here's how he remembered it in a speech last year.
I had the crazy and wild idea as I was driving home from Rockford, Illinois. There's a lot of things went into this, and I said, that's it. I want to try to start a youth organization to try and save Western civilization.
More than a decade later, Kirk said he'd met that goal.
We are now the largest organization in the conservative movement, hosting President Trump twice in 1 week. And it's just only in America is a story like that possible. So, and only thanks to the blessing of the Lord. And it came out of the grassroots of this country as a response to the secular, godless totalitarianism that we see reigning over our country.
From an early focus on libertarian themes like free markets and limited government, Kirk leaned into the MAGA movement, drawing up a watch list of professors he claimed were biased against conservatives and appealing to the religious right. Nicole Hemmer is a political historian at Vanderbilt University. She says Kirk was a bridge from the Tea Party era to the MAGA era, and stood out from others in conservative media.
His primary role is as an organizer. He was someone who immediately went to college campuses as a teenager and saw his role as, how do we get these students to identify as conservatives and how do we get them engaged in politics?
Kirk used his megaphone to amplify far-right voices and conspiracy theories. He made false claims about COVID, described the passage of the Civil Rights Act as a mistake, and promoted disproven allegations of election fraud. Here he is after Trump's loss in November 2020.
How do we explain the 100% ballot drop in Michigan, where just every ballot that was dropped was just for Joe Biden? Why is no one asking about Dominion voting systems?
Today, Turning Point USA counts more than 800 college chapters and an audience of millions who tune into its podcasts, live streams, and live events. That includes debates with college students, which Kirk became famous for.
Hello, everyone. I am Charlie Kirk, founder of Turning Point USA, and I am surrounded by 20 woke college kids.
Kirk's group of Turning Point nonprofits has expanded into voter turnout and organizing at churches. They report an annual revenue of roughly $100 million. But it's Kirk's close alignment with the Trump family, through his friendship with Donald Trump Jr., that launched him into the political stratosphere. Last year, Turning Point Action helped with the Trump campaign's voter turnout operations in key swing states, including Arizona and Wisconsin. Trump himself headlined several Turning Point rallies with Kirk.
I want to thank you all, and I want to thank Charlie Kirk for everything he's done at Turning Point Action, for making this event possible. What a great turnout.
After Trump's victory, Kirk told NPR the campaign's outreach to young voters boosted Trump.
The goal was, of course, to lose by less. But in the last couple weeks, we were whispering to each other that there might be something bigger than we can even quantify that will materialize. And turns out our gut was right.
When the race was called for Trump, Kirk choked up during his election night live stream.
We gotta hear some words here from you, Charlie. You put all this together, just, my man. Let's
just
hear it.
I am just humbled by God. God's grace. It's all God.
His co-host encouraged him to put on a red MAGA hat, saying it would soon be in the Smithsonian. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
Republicans in Georgia spent years building ties with companies in South Korea, culminating in a Hyundai locating a multi-billion dollar electric vehicle plant outside Savannah. But last week, federal immigration agents raided a battery factory at that site. They detained some 300 South Korean citizens. And as WABE's Sam Greenglass reports, the incident has put Republicans in an awkward position.
When the Trump administration announced the largest workplace immigration raid in American history, many Georgia Republicans swiftly cheered the news. "Round 'em up," posted Congressman Mike Collins. Representative Buddy Carter applauded what he called Trump's bold action. But apart from a statement by a spokesperson saying in part that Georgia remains committed to not allowing the incident to undo decades of mutually beneficial partnerships, GOP Governor Brian Kemp himself hasn't said anything.
He's the one who does have somewhat of a balancing act.
That's Republican strategist Brian Robinson.
He's got to, on the one hand, consider his politics in Georgia, but also he's got to make sure that the South Koreans feel appreciated and make sure that bridges don't get burned.
During Kemp's first campaign for governor, he ran an ad offering to round up illegal immigrants himself in his truck. This summer, he dispatched the Georgia National Guard to help with immigration enforcement. But Kemp has also pledged to make Georgia the electric mobility capital of the world, aiming to create thousands of new jobs with the help of generous state incentives. The Hyundai plant has been billed as the largest economic development project in state history. South Korean companies SK Battery and solar panel maker Qcells have invested billions here too. Kemp has even accepted the Korea Society's most prestigious award.
The peach is a meaningful symbol to us both. I understand that in Korea it represents happiness, prosperity, and longevity. That pretty well sums up Georgia's relationship with Korea.
That relationship goes back decades. In 2006, Hyundai's parent company, Kia, broke ground on a huge plant in West Georgia. Robinson remembers traveling to South Korea with Kemp's predecessor, dining with Hyundai executives at a fancy hotel in Seoul.
We had these South Korean companies come in and really transform parts of the state. All of a sudden, there's some Korean restaurants in former sleepy southern towns.
Robinson says these investments brought new life to struggling parts of rural Georgia. Trump has also urged big companies to make their products in the U.S. He was asked about the raid on Monday.
And we're going to have to train people. And the way you train people is bring people in that know what they're doing and let them stay for a little while and help. So I'm going to look at that.
On Thursday, South Korea's president said Korean companies will likely hesitate to continue investing in the U.S. without improvements to the visa system. The raid at the plant, a joint venture of Hyundai and LG Energy Solution, has also provided an opening for more populist Republicans to dial up their criticism of the foreign corporations coming into Georgia. Congressman Collins, who's running for U.S. Senate, posted, "Tax dollars should not be used to steal jobs away from Georgia workers." Collins and other Senate candidates have tried to tie Hyundai to their opponent, Democratic U.S. Senator John Ossoff, but not to Kemp. And it's not just Republicans walking a fine line.
I'm ashamed as to where we're headed. I almost wish we would take the Statue of Liberty and send it back to France because we've lost our way.
Democrats like State Senator Derek Mallow of Savannah have slammed Trump's immigration tactics.
But I also want to make sure that I don't have a corporate entity that is knowingly and intentionally subverting the law. And I also want to make sure that the people who are citizens in this state are receiving the opportunities that were promised when this project came.
A chartered Korean air jet took off from Atlanta Thursday to bring the South Koreans back to Seoul. But the economic, diplomatic, and political fallout from the incident is far from over. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Atlanta.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Milk.com. Now, that sounds like it would be the place online, the place to learn about dairy, right? Nope. It is a personal website owned by one guy and a bit of a time machine. Here's Alex Mayasi from our Planet Money team with the story.
Dan Borenstein says he got Milk.com back in 1994 based on a nickname his coworker gave him.
He knew that, like, I happened to like chocolate milk, you know, and so he started calling me Milk Boy. And, like, I resented it a little bit, but then I sort of decided, okay, I'm just going to own it.
The site is a vision of the web stuck in time. It's mostly text, fuzzy graphics, links to recipes and personal projects, and a link that says, not for sale. Then a shockingly high price tag. There's a link on your website that says you will sell it if someone shows up with $10 million. I mean, are you just waiting for a big enough bag of money?
You know, that is what a lot of people have. It's a reasonable question. There is a price, but it's like, I'm not trying to get it. I just want to live my life.
Dan doesn't even truly know what his domain is worth. For these rare pieces of internet real estate, it's not like with houses. You can't easily check what your neighbors sold for last year, which creates a business opportunity for someone like Rob Schutz.
There's a million companies that use Milk or Milk Street or Milk Movement or Milk and Honey that like would want to consolidate down to just Milk. So there are lots of people that would want this.
Rob is like a real estate agent, but for domain names. So I asked him, how much could Milk.com sell for?
I'd say anywhere from mid six figures and up.
So maybe not $10 million, but memorable one-word domains like Milk.com are rare, and that makes them really valuable to companies. Economists call this costly signaling. It's like when you see a Super Bowl ad. You assume that company must be pretty successful if they can pay for Super Bowl ads. Take the startup DoorBot. They made video doorbells. Back in 2013, they were struggling. But then they spent $1 million on a domain name, Ring.com, and made it the new name of their company. In 2018, Amazon bought Ring for nearly $1 billion. The company's founder said their new domain name was a really important part of the turnaround.
You talk to some founders and they think it makes a tremendous difference, right? From a legitimacy, reputation standpoint, if you have that one word .com, you're a real company.
Chocolate.com apparently sold for over $1 million. Last year, Rocket Mortgage bought Rocket.com for a reported $14 million. And ChatGPT bought Chat.com for more than $10 million. So as more of these domains get bought up, like real estate in a historic city center, sites like Milk.com get a little rarer and maybe a little more valuable if Dan ever decides to sell. For NPR News, I'm Alex Mayasi.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. After Dark is KAXE's Saturday night program after Green Cheese from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk, metal, EDM, R&B, hip-hop, and more. This week's hosts, Casty and McKeon Hugh Roberts, will be playing punk rock. Interested in hosting? Email dgannon at kaxe.org. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic, with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. Mixed Precipitation Opera and Theater Group presents Pickup Truck Opera Volume 5, Saturday, September 13th at 3 p.m. at the Mask and Rose Theater in Popaski. Support for KAXE comes from the 17th Annual Community Connect, Thursday, September 18th from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids, featuring over 50 social service agencies providing information on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. More info can be found by dialing 211. See a local food demonstration at the Grand Rapids Farmers Market Saturday, September 13th at 10 a.m. Learn how to make apple cabbage salad. There will be a limited number of free ingredient kits available. Greenwood Cemetery in Bemidji is looking for volunteers to help with recovery efforts after this summer's derecho. Anyone with availability and equipment is welcome to join the effort before winter comes. Text KAXE at 218-326-1234 for contact information. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The FBI has released security camera images of what they are calling a person of interest in the shooting yesterday of political activist Charlie Kirk. And they say they've recovered the rifle that may have been used. Kirk was killed during an outdoor event at Utah Valley University, which highlights the tension between security and free speech on college campuses. NPR law enforcement correspondent Martin Casti is tracking that. And Martin, tell me a little bit more. What kind of security was there yesterday at the Charlie Kirk event?
Well, this was a big outdoor event, about 3,000 people in kind of an amphitheater-shaped space. And it's believed that the shot came mm-hmm. from a rooftop overlooking that area. The university police chief said six officers were working the event. Charlie Kirk also had his own security detail there. But witnesses who were there say that the security felt minimal. For instance, some people say they got into the area without any kind of bag check.
Is that typical on a college campus? I'm thinking especially for someone who is politically controversial, like Charlie Kirk.
Well, that's the question I had for Richard Berry. He was a chief of police for 11 years at the University of Central Florida, and that's a big place, 70,000 students. And during his time, he had a lot of high-profile visitors, including Charlie Kirk, he told me. And he said that there's no real rule of thumb for how many officers you need for a given size of event or for other factors, such as whether to have checkpoints. And he says, really, the level of security should be a function of the known risk of what police are hearing about potential threats, what this person has inspired in other places, and they look at what's happening elsewhere in the country, such as what happened yesterday at UVU.
Anytime you have this type of violence, it's a game changer. You're constantly trying to evaluate the security need versus the freedom on campus. It's a constant balancing act that police chiefs do on a daily basis, and sometimes people don't like it.
As an example, he says back in 2016, after the mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub there in Orlando, that they redid their whole security layout for big events and football games.
Yeah, I want to go back to that point he made about freedom on campus. Free speech has mm-hmm. been such a live issue on college campuses for other reasons in recent months. Could incidents like this make it less likely that campuses will invite controversial speakers?
No, there's no doubt that's a concern for people like Robert Shibley. He's the special counsel for campus advocacy at FIRE. You may have heard of him. That's the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Every year, that group does a survey of college students. And the 2025 survey just came out right before the Utah shooting. It showed a slight increase in the percentage of students who say it's acceptable to shout down certain speakers. That's at 72%. And there was an increase in how many say it's acceptable to use violence, at least in some cases, to shut down a speaker. That was up a couple of points to 34%.
The more acceptable people see violence as being, the more likely we are to see people resort to that. And, you know, the real nightmare scenario would be sort of a tit-for-tat escalation, attempting to silence one another with political violence.
Is there reason, Martin, to believe, is there data to support the idea that this kind of violence is trending up on college campuses?
You know, campus security experts tell me no. They say, if anything, things were probably worse about 7 or 8 years ago, back during the first Trump administration, when some of these alt-right provocateurs, such as Milo Yiannopoulos, would go to campuses and sort of provoke a big reaction. And during those years, free speech groups such as FIRE would accuse the colleges of using undefined safety concerns as an excuse to cancel or restrict those appearances. That phenomenon was sometimes called the heckler's veto. And anecdotally, security experts say now that has become a lot rarer. But after this shooting, one of them said he hopes we won't be seeing a new kind of veto when it comes to free speech, what he called the assassin's veto.
Wow. And NPR's Martin Casti, thank you.
You're welcome.
The world lost an icon when Latin jazz pioneer Eddie Palmieri died last month. His music lives on through recordings, but also through sheet music. That's thanks in part to a publisher in rural California. As KVPR's Carrie Klein reports, this pioneer has helped make the work of Palmieri and other Latin jazz artists available to the world from his home office in Madeira.
Steve Alcala is a music teacher and trumpet player. He joined a mariachi band in high school, studied jazz in college, and in the 1980s became a high school music teacher. It was then that he heard something that changed his life.
I go, whoa, this is cool. I love this.
It was Latin jazz. Think salsa and American jazz and Afro-Caribbean rhythms all woven together, like in this piece by Eddie Palmieri.
I was thinking to myself, man, I think the kids would really like playing this stuff.
But there was a problem. He couldn't find the sheet music that would help his kids learn.
That's their textbook. It's just like math. You have to have a textbook.
Pioneers who were performing Latin jazz typically weren't sharing their sheet music beyond their bands. That left students and musicians outside of major jazz scenes without an easy way to learn the music. So Alcala set out on a painstaking task.
I had to do all the transcribing myself from records I used to listen to.
He'd literally write down the musical arrangements he heard, note by note, sometimes for 10 or 15 different instruments.
And the kids really loved it.
So did other band leaders. They started asking him where he found this music, and that got him thinking.
And then I said, you know what, there's a need here for that, so I'm going to go ahead and start a publishing company.
He started cold calling the biggest performers.
And then I give him my spiel about teaching Latin jazz at Roosevelt High School, and would I be able to get their arrangements from them?
The idea took off. Alcala named his company 3-2 Music. It's a nod to a common Afro-Caribbean rhythm.
Bum, bum, bum.
Now, Alcala publishes sheet music by more than 70 Latin jazz composers and pays them royalties.
Japan buys a lot of music from me. Germany loves Latin jazz. Austria. And there was one particular group that played in Iraq during the war.
Military bands and especially school bands are his biggest customers, including the jazz orchestra at Fresno State University. The band's director, Richard Lloyd Giddens Jr., was Alcala's student back in the 90s. He's now using that same sheet music he played with his students. He says before 3-2 Music, teaching Latin jazz was nearly impossible.
And now there's an outlet, there's a vehicle, there's a platform where this music exists that people can find this music and perform it.
Giddens students, like Trevor Cabose, say they're grateful to have access to this genre.
Latin music, Afro-Cuban music, West African music has such a profound effect on my life and everything I do in music.
Composers appreciate 3-2 Music as well. One of the first to publish with the company was Oscar Hernandez. He's won 3 Grammys, and yet he says hearing students play his work is a thrill.
For me to see young people learning the music, man, that's where it all starts.
And Latin jazz experts say that by giving more students access to this music, Alcala and his business have helped popularize it around the world. For NPR News, I'm Terry Klein in Fresno.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. From the University of Maryland Libraries, committed to reimagining learning, advancing the public good, and empowering research that creates a better future for everyone. More at lib.umd.edu. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options. At progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy skies with lows 50 to 60 degrees. Tomorrow, slight chance of showers in the morning, partly sunny with temps in the mid to upper 70s. And Saturday, partly sunny with highs in the upper 70s, low 80s.